You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As we have discussed many times on the show, language is changing all the time. This year, many of the new words that crept into popular speech were election and politics related. And here to talk with us about the best and worst words of 2012 is Ben Zimmer, executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com. He's also the language columnist for the Boston Globe and the chair of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
And we're also inviting our listeners to join the conversation. If you had a favorite or least favorite word that was popular this past year, or a question about the definition about a new word, because some of these words I read and I'm not sure exactly what I'm supposed to infer from them, and then I feel stupid and old. But anyway, if all of that has afflicted you, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So, Ben, do you tend to have a favorite word each year? Or do you just have to go through them all because it's your job?
I try not to play favorites or be too behind one word or another word. I like to sort of gather it all in. And as chair of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society, it's my job working with the others in the society to try to figure out what should we select as the word of the year. This has been an interesting year for words. I don't think there's any real clear front runner, one prohibitive favorite. Last year around this time, it seemed pretty obvious, for instance, that occupy was going to be the word of the year. And sure enough, when we gathered for our annual meeting, that was what was selected. So there's no prohibitive favorite like that this time around. But there were certainly a lot of interesting words from politics and other spheres of life.
But you have suggested that double down is one of the ones that you think is important. It's a poker term. How did it wind up being used in politics?
Blackjack, actually. But
Now you know why I'm always confused.
So in blackjack, if you feel very confident, you can ask for just one more card, and that allows you to double your bet. So it's kind of a high stakes and high reward gambling move in blackjack. And so that's been applied metaphorically to all sorts of things. We heard it this year in politics and in tech and so forth. It can be used positively. For instance, Mark Zuckerberg was telling people after the disappointing Facebook IPO that it was actually time to double down on Facebook. But then it can also be used negatively. So, for instance, Bill Clinton, when he was talking about Mitt Romney, said that he was someone who would double down on trickle down. It was a nice little turn of phrase by Clinton. So this and I think other gambling metaphors have crept into our usage a lot. I think we like talking this way. Maybe it harks back to the days of the frontier and being risky and audacious.
But the way it got used most of the time would be like, Todd Akin doubles down on his statements about rape and abortion. Right. It was kind of a person made some statement. He was criticized, and then he'd come back with a defense. And,
right.
And double down got applied to that.
Yeah, and it became a kind of a media cliche this year, I think, a lot with statements that Romney made, for instance, after Benghazi. He sort of doubled down on his rebuke of Obama after that and so forth. It tends to be used in this way to talk about, well, you're already in a kind of a precarious position, but you're going to go all in, to use another gambling metaphor. That one really does come from poker, and just stick to your guns.
Another word a lot of people liked was malarkey when Joe Biden used it. It's an oldie. Is that word really Irish, as he claimed?
Well, yeah, he said in the debate with Ryan that it was an Irish word, and we don't have evidence for it actually coming from Irish, but we do know that when it was popularized in the early 20th century, it was Irish-American writers, very often newspaper writers, who were using this word malarkey as a colorful word to mean a lot of nonsense. So it does have that Irish-American tradition that Biden was drawing on, and it's a great evocative word, and even though it's been around for a while, there was a lot of interest in that word after Biden used it in the debate.
So we don't hear malarkey much, and then suddenly somebody uses it Moxie is another word that right. seems to be brought up every once in a while, and then suddenly people use it for about 2 weeks, and then it disappears again.
Yeah,
but they don't go away completely.
No, it's rare for words that have come into circulation to completely die away. Very often they can be revived in that way, and that's one of the joys of language is we can dust off these older words and make them come to life in new ways.
But we also had a number of blended words that were invented this year, words like Romnesia and Obamaloney, obviously invented by the opposing campaigns.
Yeah, this is a tradition in American politics. You could go all the way back 200 years for gerrymander when the Massachusetts governor Elbridge Gerry was combined with a salamander to create that political blend that we still use today to talk about these convoluted districts. So that's been going on for a long time, but I think there was something about Obama and Romney's names that lend themselves to this kind of play, and so we heard a lot of that this year.
And do you think that they're intended to go viral?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, obviously, if the Obama campaign is using the term Romnesia, or if the Romney campaign is using the term Obamaloney, then they're hoping that these funny little expressions will catch on and have some sort of viral spread that, you know, people will start using it in that way.
What about Obamacare? Was it given a new meaning during this year when the Obama administration co-opted it?
Definitely. I mean, that was an interesting development to watch because Obamacare had generally been used pejoratively previous to this year before the Obama campaign decided to heck with it. We're just going to embrace this term, even if it kind of brands it in this particular way, rather than talking about the Affordable Care Act. They felt comfortable, Obama himself felt comfortable using this term Obamacare, and they decided, you know, that they were just going to use that during the campaign as well.
But we've seen that throughout the history of the world. For example, Impressionism, Cubism, Fauvism, they were all invented to insult the artists who were working in those styles, and then they became adopted by them.
It's true. And again, that just shows the flexibility of language, is that a word that can be pejorative can actually be reclaimed, co-opted, and readapted for positive purposes.
I'm talking with Ben Zimmer about the best and worst words of 2012. We haven't yet decided whether these words are good or bad. There are some words I think we will definitely say are bad. Last year was all about the 99% and the 1% from the Occupy movement. This year the phrase was the 47% from Mitt Romney's leaked fundraiser. What about 47% caught people's attention more, let's say, than some of the other unflattering words Romney used, like takers?
Right. Well, it's interesting. You know, if we look back on the Occupy movement and what their legacy was, we're not necessarily talking about Occupy in the same way that we were a year ago, but introducing the idea of the 99% and the 1% and dividing up the country into percentages on economic lines was, I think, a way that talking that we saw reappear with the 47% talk. So then when Romney talked about the 47% and he was talking about the people who do not pay federal income tax and therefore, according to Romney, were predisposed to vote for Obama, I think that caught people's interest because of the sort of the idea of the X percent that had already been established. And so it ended up being a useful tool against Romney after that video was leaked. And it really worked in Obama's favor because this sort of talk of the 47% didn't help Romney, of course. And in fact, in an ironic twist, it was Romney who ended up with just about 47% of the vote in the end.
Well, I wonder about some of those phrases, whether it's the candidate who actually invents them or whether it's something that the campaign suggests he use, like self-deportation, another word that it was associated with Mitt Romney and all of his talk about Obama's apology tour
right.
that he used throughout the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the campaigns did a lot of focus grouping and testing of these words and phrases to see how they would play. But of course, you know, if we look at the primary race for Romney, something like self-deportation might have worked just fine. But then when it came to the general election, it didn't help him at all with the Latino vote, of course, to use that word. He tried to back away from it, but I think he had become so, you know, tied to that word. It was hard for him to avoid, you know, having that word become a problem for him with the Latino vote.
So backing away is the opposite of doubling down?
That's right. He did not double down on self-deportation, but he tried to make a shift. And, of course, one of his advisors referred to this as like shaking up an Etch-a-Sketch, and that was an unfortunate turn of phrase that the Democrats seized upon as well to describe Romney's shifts of policy positions.
Let me double down on the phone number. It's 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a question or a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And Tony from Boonton, is it Boonton?
Boonton, New Jersey.
New Jersey. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. The word, my bad, I used to teach drama, so I'm very aware of subtext. And I would take the word, my bad, and I could contemporize that into the Iceman cometh, where Jason Roberts cannot feel any sorrow, any pain for his wife. So when somebody says, my bad, my interpretation is the subtext. Is I'm proud of what I understand and feel. It's too bad that you're so sensitive to my bad, but it's not a sincere I'm sorry.
Now, my bad is, what, about 10 years old now?
It's actually older than that. I mean, it's been popular for the past decade or so, but as far as we know, it actually goes back to pickup basketball games. That was where it first became popularized, I believe, in the 1980s, actually. If you're on the court and you make a mistake, you just say, my bad, as a way to own up to it. It became popular in basketball circles. For instance, the basketball player Manute Bol liked to use it, and it kind of spread from there. I would differ from the caller in saying that I think that when people say my bad, they tend to mean it. It's just a modern form of mea culpa. And
it's not the same as humble brag.
No, humble brag. Well, that was a great word from last year, right, where you have a kind of a faux humility. But if you say my bad, I mean, generally that's just a way to quickly own up to a mistake without belaboring it.
We are seeing a lot of basketball terms enter the lexicon. Ball don't lie.
Right. Yeah.
I suspect every pickup game in Brooklyn will have somebody yell ball don't lie when somebody doesn't make a foul shot.
Yeah, I mean, it's great how sometimes these things can bubble up from a particular subculture and then catch on more widely.
A political term that's not specific to the election is frackademia, which must have something to do with fracking. What does that term describe?
Well, yeah, frackademia, that's another interesting blend. People might already be familiar with fracking, this term to refer to hydraulic fracturing as a way to drill for natural gas. This year, there were anti-fracking activists who sought to expose the financial ties that scholars had who were involved in this pro-fracking research. They actually were funded by industries that benefited from fracking. And so as a way of drawing attention to this, the activists invented a new word. They said this was fracademia, combining fracking and academia. And these were fracademics who were involved in this kind of research that was actually paid for.
We've got to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at some more words with Ben Zimmer, who is the executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com, also the language columnist for the Boston Globe, and the chair of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society. When do you decide on the official new words?
The selection will actually be at our annual meeting in Boston, which is going to be on January 4th, and that's when you'll hear about what our selection is.
Okay, well, we will come back with calls and more words right after we take this little break. We're back with Ben Zimmer talking about the best and worst words of 2012. And Ben, during that break, I used words like podcast, Twitter, Facebook. Didn't think twice about it. Assume everybody knew those words. And these are all new words that have become a part of the language, and I'm assuming will remain a part of the language until Twitter is replaced by something else, or we no longer have podcasts. We have some other invention that will replace it.
Yes, certainly in the tech world, we see terms catch on very quickly as technology develops or new ways of interacting online develop. And so we often look at those as well as Word of the Year candidates. Podcast was once in the running when that was a popular word, and it continues to be popular. So, yeah, I mean, as long as we use these technologies and we need names for them, then they will certainly keep in circulation.
But why do you think some don't go away? For example, we still dial the phone even though we don't dial the phone.
That's true. I mean, that's an interesting little phenomenon where this kind of anachronistic use of that relates to a bygone technology still will linger even after the technology itself has moved on. So we can dial the phone, we can turn the channel, all these things that we're not literally doing anymore, even though the terms we use stick around even with new activities.
And now we have all these other phrases. Tablet means something quite different today than it did in the past.
That's true. So tablet, of course, as a small computer that you can carry around with you, and we're familiar with the iPad and all of the competitors for the tablet. Although now they're getting smaller, and there's this space between smartphones and tablets that people are trying to name now, unsuccessfully, I think. There's one term that's been used, which is phablet, phablet, which is a blend of phone and tablet. And people are kind of grasping for what to call this new thing, like the Samsung Galaxy Note, which is sort of in between. And I don't think people have really hit upon the term that people are going to be using yet.
Well, when people take a normal word and then make it into a brand name, like Think, Windows, we wind up with a whole new meaning to a common word.
Yeah, and tech companies particularly like taking these common words and associating them with their brands, and then will fight for those words so that other people can't use them. So Facebook will go after you. If you have something similar to what they have and use either face or book, they can actually sue you for using those common words.
And you can't call your local restaurant McDonald's even though your name is McDonald's.
That's true.
Reggie from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
How are you? I think our the most embarrassing word of the year, and it's certainly the New York word, is superstorm. I mean, I like tropical storm, but superstorm, it's so cheap.
Well, it was Superstorm. We went from Hurricane Sandy to Superstorm Sandy to Frankenstorm Sandy.
Yeah, we had a lot of terms for Sandy. Part of the problem was that when the hurricane makes landfall, it's technically no longer a hurricane. So we call it a storm, but it's not just a storm. It's something bigger, especially with Sandy, where it was combining with these other weather systems. And that's why Frankenstorm was first suggested by someone at the National Weather Service as a kind of a hybrid, like Frankenstein's monster, and also because it was hitting around Halloween. CNN and other news outlets said, we're not going to use Frankenstorm because that seemed too lighthearted. It seemed like it would trivialize the storm. And so Superstorm is what people decided would be used. It seemed less trivial somehow than calling it Frankenstorm. But that was just because a name was needed, and that super prefix is useful. We've seen it in other things this year, of course, like super PACs and so forth.
And we still are using gate on everything. I guess
right.
That will continue to the end of time.
Well, it certainly lasted for a long time, and so that any little controversy or scandal immediately gets the gate suffix attached to it.
Well, we're starting to see foreign words also come into the language. The biggest music video of the year was Gangnam by the Korean pop star Psy.
Gangnam Style, right?
Yes, Gangnam Style is people often saying now, Oppa, Gangnam Style. when they do, of course, I know I've heard the phrase. I have no idea what the heck they're talking about.
Right. Well, that's from Korea, and it was very interesting that this Korean language pop song became this international sensation. A billion views on YouTube for the video, and the vast majority, of course, can't understand Korean, and yet they're singing along with Psy saying Oppam Gangnam Style, which in Korean means Oppam means like big brother, which he's using to refer to himself, and he's saying he is in the style of Gangnam, this trendy district in Seoul, South Korea. So that became popular this year, even among people who really had no idea what it meant. And so Gangnam Style, I think, just got attached to the silly antics that Psy, the singer, was using in the video.
Now, Becky left a comment mentioning that the phrase thrown under the bus was used quite a bit during the past year. This is not a new phrase, but it's interesting to see what phrases get revived.
Yeah, well, I believe the throwing under the bus metaphor goes back to the 1980s, and it's become popular certainly in politics, where there's all sorts of machinations, and one person can kind of sacrifice another person for his or her political ambitions, and so that gets called getting thrown under the bus. Of course, these things become cliches, and so that one or you know other ones that get used too often, including doubling down, I think sometimes need to be retired for a little while until we find some new metaphors.
Charlotte from Queens, how are you on the air?
Yes, hi. I'm sure you probably noticed the use of the word robust, which I think started in medicine to describe a response to a drug that wasn't quite significant, which has a specific meaning in statistically. So they used robust to say, you know, patient's response to this drug was robust, particularly robust. And then it spread to every field that I can think of.
So this is not uncommon, is it? We hear a word used in one way, and then other people say, hey, I can use it
right.
as well.
Yeah, I mean, and with a word like robust, it has a longer history than that, and it certainly has taken on technical meanings, for instance, in the medical profession. And then it's true that a word like robust has become very popular, applied to all sorts of things. We can talk about robust technology, for instance. The tech world likes using that word a lot. And again, it can sort of reach a cliche status when people are overusing it. But a word like robust certainly has been robust across a number of different fields.
My guest is Ben Zimmer. We're talking about the best and worst words of 2012. And a word will be chosen sometime in the near future.
Yes, on January 4th will be when our selection is made. There have been various other groups, dictionary publishers and so forth, which have been selecting their own words of the year. The American Dialect Society is the granddaddy of all the word of the year selection processes, and that's been going on actually since 1990. It was the first time the society picked a word of the year.
How many of those words have survived?
Well, it's a spotty track record, for instance, back in 1990, the word that was selected is a little embarrassing to look back upon because it was bush lips, which was a term that referred to
read my lips.
Read my lips, no new taxes. And so bush lips for Bush the Elder as a kind of insincere political promise. But, you know, we actually have other categories, not just word of the year, which is supposed to say something about the, you know, how we live our lives this year. We also have other categories like most useful or most likely to succeed for those words that we really think are going to stand the test of time.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. An internet term that's had a strong effect is doxing. Where does that come from and what does it mean?
Yeah, doxing, that's an interesting one. D-O-X, or sometimes spelled D-O-X-X-I-N-G, is a term that means revealing someone's personal information, their name, their addresses, their phone numbers, and so forth. When it's a person who would normally be behind a pseudonym online, and you reveal them, you out them by publishing this information. And it comes from online forums where these publicly available records are called docs, D-O-X, short for documents. And it became popular this year the website Gawker unmasked the identity of a moderator from the site Reddit, and they talked about that as doxing because he had previously just used a pseudonym, and now his name was out there and everybody knew who he was.
In the past, that would have been outing, wouldn't it?
Right. Outing has been used for that. It's interesting. I mean, it's a kind of a public shaming in some ways to reveal someone's identity this way, and doxing is the term that the techie folks have used for that.
Kay from Ridgefield, Connecticut. Hi, you're on there.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the idea of how much of internet speak has become common language and the use of kind of hashtag from Twitter and then how that's kind of become part of other internet language and then also part of spoken word.
So hashtag, do you use that in your normal conversation or do you only use it when you're talking about Twitter?
I don't personally, but I have heard it been used, which I've kind of found surprising.
In what way? He has a new hashtag?
Like, someone might say, like, hashtag first world problems or something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Which I think is probably a common one.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, we see these hashtags, which are used on Twitter as a way of kind of organizing conversation, or also sometimes to have a kind of ironic commentary or meta commentary on what you're saying. And so the hashtag, like, first world problems has become popular on Twitter. And when you try to apply that to just speaking and you say, hashtag first world problems. It's a kind of a conscious nod to the fact that this originated from Twitter and you're bringing it into your own, you know, regular discourse. I see that still as a very sort of self-conscious transfer from the world of Twitter, from the Twitterverse. It's interesting to see how that happens, where a particular style of communicating has developed on Twitter and you know, allows you to make this kind of ironic commentary by use of hashtags, and people are actually trying to apply that to other online communication as well as spoken communication.
Bob from, where are you from? Rego Park?
Rego Park.
Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Lennon, how you doing? Great show as usual. I'm hearing the expression a lot, what's your take? Maria Bartiromo, CNBC, all these cable people. Where's the origin of that statement? I'm hearing it so often, everyone is repeating it. What's your take on the issue?
And what's your take on that question? Or is that also part of the takeaway trend? We have a radio show on
the
station
away,
called
sure.
The Takeaway.
Yeah. Take is one of those infinitely flexible words. If you look up take in the dictionary, you'll see it going on for pages. It's one of the verbs that lexicographers refer to as the big eight, because they just can go on and on with so many different possible meanings, and usually as a verb but also as a noun, as the caller suggests, what's your take, and can be combined with other words like takeaway as well. A word like that, I'm not sure exactly where that particular meaning of take originated from, but it just goes to show how very, very simple words are building blocks that we can use to, you know, continue to enliven the language.
But in the end, it winds up meaning, how do you interpret this thing?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What do you take from it? So it's not actually physically taking something into your possession. It's just another kind of metaphorical extension of the word.
John Stewart often makes fun of these fad words by having showing 20 or 30 different commentators all using the same thing.
That's true.
And it does seem like it suggests that people don't always think for themselves.
Well, if we look at media commentators, especially the 24-hour cable news cycle, and they have to fill up so much time with talk, very often they rely on things that they've heard other people use. And so an expression like double down or whatever may just catch on, and then you just hear everyone using it as a kind of a linguistic crutch almost.
Lincoln, hi, you're on the air. Lincoln from Manhattan.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I'm just mostly interested in this phenomenon within language that we now call, I think, uptalk, where a statement is expressed as with the ending of a question, as if to indicate that the person isn't quite sure about what they're saying.
Or, well, this is what is often described as Val Girl. Way of speaking, but that goes back a long time, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So uptalk, that rising intonation at the end of things that you're saying, can often imply that you're not quite sure, and that there's some question, instead of having the intonation go down at the end of your utterance. It was associated with Valley Girls in the 80s, and since then has often been attached to other groups, young people, women, and so forth, even though if you listen carefully, you will often hear men and older people using it as well. But there's a certain kind of stereotype with that intonation that's been attached to particularly young female speakers.
But young people definitely use the word like in every sentence.
It's true. I mean, I think that each generation has its own mannerisms and tics, and like, as what linguists call a discourse filler, has certainly been quite popular for the past few decades.
The Oxford Dictionary's UK word of the year was omnishambles. Where did that come from?
Omnishambles is a great word that comes from a British comedy, a television comedy, The Thick of It, and it was used on that show and then took on a life of its own in British politics. Omnishambles meaning, as Oxford described it, a situation that has been comprehensively mismanaged. So you have that omni prefix attached to shambles. And that took off this year, including an American spin on it when Mitt Romney visited the UK before the Olympics, and the trip was full of gaffes and unfortunate comments. And so that got called Romney shambles in the UK press.
Well, also another new British word connected to the Olympics was Voldesport.
Right. That's another great blend. And that originated because the London Olympics, they were being very careful about the rules on who could refer to the Olympics, because that was actually trademarked, and you had to be very careful. You couldn't actually refer to the Olympics unless you were an official sponsor or something like that.
Can you actually trademark a word like the Olympics, which goes back to ancient Greece?
Well, if you're referring to an event that they have some sort of proprietary right to, yes. And the Super Bowl is another example of that.
I'm trademark Leonard Lopate.
So a British bookstore chain, Waterstones, someone tweeted that, well, we can't talk about this big sporting event that's going on because we're not a sponsor. So we're going to call it Voldesport, which was a clever thing to refer to Voldemort, the Harry Potter character who must not be named. So Voldesport was the sporting event that could not be named.
A word that wasn't on your list but that's been used a lot, this word, is photobomb. Do you know what a photobomb is?
Right. Yeah, that's a part of a sort of whole trend of various photo fads online. And so photobombing, I believe, is just when a person kind of gets into the shot that someone is taking, maybe making a funny face or whatever, and is kind of spoiling the picture. Of course, people, I'm sure, have been doing that as long as there have been photographs. But sharing those funny pictures got popular, and very often these fads then need a particular name. And so that's what that's
And a related
called.
Word is selfie.
Selfie, right. Yeah, again, if you take a picture of yourself with your smartphone and you post it on Facebook, then that gets called a selfie these days. But very often you have to hold your smartphone at a weird angle, often making a strange face, like puckering up your lips in this expression that's called the duck face that we see young people using in their Facebook profiles these days. And so selfie is one of those words that has spread through social media.
I don't know whether I should mention the word you say is your least favorite word, because it's rather disgusting. But can you do a cleaned-up version?
Well, let's see. I think you're talking about one that was on my list, butt-chugging.
Yes.
This unfortunate term that came to light this year because the University of Tennessee had a fraternity where a student was hospitalized for alcohol poisoning, and reports said that he had engaged in this kind of alcoholic enema called butt-chugging. And it's just an unpleasant term for an unpleasant practice, but it was sort of thrust into national news by this incident.
Another phrase that I liked was hate watching, about watching television shows that you don't like.
Yeah, it's this kind of masochistic practice where you just despise a television show, but you keep watching it. And I think people have been doing that for a long time, but this was the year that this term hate watching really got applied to it and got popularized in places like Twitter, where people might gather together to talk about what a terrible show this is that we feel compelled to watch.
We'll probably have you back after you decide what the word of the year is, and talk a bit more about some of the other words. A lot of people wanted to talk about YOLO, which we discussed last year,
right.
But I'm sure it'll come up again. My great thanks to Ben Zimmer, executive producer of the Visual Thesaurus and Vocabulary.com, also language columnist for the Boston Globe, and most important in this conversation, the chair of the New Words Committee of the American Dialect Society. Hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for having me.